Dr. Glass. Stu? Dr. Glass.
Well, John and I talked about the possibilities. He assured me that as chief academic officer, I would have full responsibility and control over not only the usual academic life of the college, but the College of Liberal Arts, but of the development of the various new kinds of programs that were already on the cards for this campus.
What were some of them?
Well, I was going to enumerate them. First of all, the Health Sciences Center. What should that be? What should it include? So on. Next, a Marine Sciences Center. And third, a Center for Continuing Education. Showed me the plan for the construction envisaged, and there was already in the early blueprints or outlines money, not top priority, but set aside for a Center for Continuing Education. But nobody had any idea what this might be, or how it would function. And it would be my task to get these new things like the Health Sciences Center, the Marine Sciences Center, and the Center for Continuing Education going. And of course then there would be the usual problems of academic administration, chairmanships, recruitment would be a tremendous job because the institution was due to expand a great deal. I hadn't been here very long before I could see that although the early faculty had been recruited well for the jobs of teaching, they had not been very well recruited for an institution that was expected to become the research focus of the State University of New York. And a great deal would have to be done to shift the emphasis and get in people who, while they would not ignore teaching, would be primarily highly respected in the areas of research in their fields. And then, of course, I had also in mind the importance of the personnel problems and the policies that would avoid the constant violations of academic freedom that go on in most places in connection with promotions and tenure.
Right.
I wanted to see whether it would really be possible to run an institution like Stony Brook on good AAUP principles.
Right.
And
that's very important.
Yes,
very important.
In picking my first assistants, for example, I found, I think, just the right person, Charlie Hoffman, to help me with that job. And I laid it on the line. I said, the main trouble is that people slide into tenure without having been properly judged and given notice at the right time. And we've got to remember that everyone who has been on the faculty for 5 years has got to be given judgment in the succeeding year, so that he or she can be informed by the end of the sixth year whether or not to expect tenure or to seek work elsewhere. And there's not going to be any sliding into tenure. I found there was already a good tenure system, a good, strong personnel policy committee of the faculty here, and that the machinery existed. It was only the negligence of certain chairmen that we had to worry about, who would not bring people up, not give them the information that they had to get things ready to present for a judgment at the right time. And so Charlie was my troubleshooter there. He would make sure that every department chairman got word early in January of what particular persons were expected to have a judgment. And that meant give them time to prepare whatever they wanted to do to indicate their achievements, and give the department time to think things over and make a recommendation properly. And I think that during my 6 years as academic vice president, we never slipped up on that at all. Not one time.
Oh, that's a good record.
But, and always it worked so well that when the department made a recommendation and the Faculty Personnel Policy Committee studied the cases and made its recommendation, and then I went over the documents and made my recommendation, it always went right through without any question. There were only,
I read through two cases, Johnny.
What?
Your recommendation went to John Toe.
Yes, right. But he had already agreed when we considered my coming here that this was my bailiwick, and he would not interfere unless there was some really overriding reason, and he lived up to that. As far as I recall, there were only two cases where we had something of a difference of opinion. One of them he gave in on rather easily. That was a young woman, I won't mention her by name, very, very able scholar and teacher, who was a lesbian. He was afraid this wouldn't set well with the community, and it's early, late 60s, you know, not like today. And I stood up for her. That went through. And the second one was a very notorious case. I don't mind mentioning names here because it's all pretty well known and open. In the late 60s, as you know, there were lots of troubles on campus associated with demonstrations and the Vietnam opposition and so on. And sometimes there were serious sit-ins, and sometimes there were even demonstrations in front of buildings and break-ins at the computing center, for example. And there was one young faculty member who did not have tenure. He was an assistant professor in economics, who wore his hair long and tried to be one of the boys with the more radical students. And whenever there was a demonstration, he was around, not necessarily taking part in it, but always on the fringes. And at the time of the break into the computing center when there was really quite a bit of destruction. The campus police reported that he was there and thought he was in the building, went into the building, whether he actually helped in the break in or not. But it turned out when they were pressed harder for their witness on oath, they were not so sure whether he was in the building or not, but he was certainly there in the crowd.
Right.
And he became quite well known as a radical member of the campus, always supporting the students in their demonstrations and riding. He came up for promotion and tenure. The department said, on the basis of its proper consideration of his teaching and his research, he's a fine teacher and he is doing excellent research. We expect great things of him as an economist. The Personnel Policy Committee went over all of the records and came to the same conclusion. I went over them all again, and I had to come to the same conclusion. You had to balance this man's academic performance, on the one hand, against his activities as a citizen living on campus, the other. And I therefore made the recommendation that Michael Zweig be promoted to tenure to an associate professorship. John A. was very upset. He really thought this would bring down on us the wrath of Albany. There were not only people in the central administration of the university there, but also people in the legislature, perhaps in the governor's office, who were well aware of Michael Zweig's activities, and they would cut down on our budget, our appropriations, and we just couldn't afford to do this. And I stood my ground, and much against his own feelings, Johnny finally gave in and sent the recommendation up. It went through. And I think time has shown in both cases that those were very wise decisions. Like so many young radicals, Zweig has tamed considerably as he's gotten older. He's still somewhat radical politically, but nothing like he was. Not so obstreperous.
Yeah.
And he's a very good teacher, a very good economist. And with Charlie Hoffman's help in that respect, I really had very little problem with the issues of academic freedom and tenure on campus. Later, after I retired from the office, gone away from my sabbatical year and come back as a professor, I differed bitterly with John over his decision to discontinue the Department of Education and dismiss all those professors, many of whom had tenure. And he thought that with the tenured one, there'd really be no problem. Other departments could pick them up. Well, I knew damn well that this wouldn't happen.
Now,
there were two who would not have any problem: Eli Seifman and Aaron Carter.
Aaron who?
Carton. And the others, it was very dubious whether any department would feel that they had to open a place for them or not. And this was one of the things that later got the State University of New York as a whole, including Stony Brook, put on the list of censured administrations by the AAUP, where it still is.
Is that right? I didn't realize that. Well, I think I think that universities and university faculty complain about the quality of students they receive, and yet there are many institutions that feel that the training of teachers adequately is beneath them.
Yes.
And they are hoist with their own petard, I think.
Well, this is a complicated issue. I wanted to talk about the establishment of Center for Continuing Education, CED, the problems with deans and or directors. Weren't have a dean to start with. But I'll say this right now, that program grew and grew and grew until by 1970
education.
Yeah, right. We had so many enrolled at a graduate level that when you counted full-time equivalents at the graduate level, CED was supporting the whole graduate school. I mean, the budget that's appropriated in Albany is on the basis of full-time equivalent students.
Right.
And of course, our graduate students in chemistry and physics and biology, they're relatively few in numbers, and they cost lots of money, and they all have to have support. And there are not enough teaching assistantships to go around. CED was able not only to supply the full-time equivalents to keep the whole graduate program going, but it also supplied a lot of teaching assistantships for graduate students who were needed to conduct those discussion sections. My big course, I started as a part of CED, Science and the Future of Man.
I was one of your...
Yeah, you were one of those
sections.
But I also used a lot of not young, but more mature graduate students in that to carry the discussion sections. And all of that supported the graduate school. It was a very serious whack at the root of the tree. Because I knew, Johnny couldn't seem to see it, that you dismantle the Department of Education. I admit it was not doing a good job. It was not composed of the best faculty. But it at least had a big training program for teachers. I think he was more concerned by the fact that Hofstra and Post and some of the other schools on the island were complaining that we were taking their bread and butter away from them by training teachers so much. And what the teachers were saying, Stony Brook doesn't care about teachers. It's dismantled its education department. Its teacher training programs are shot. And CED is the casualty. They stopped coming by droves. Was a big drop in enrollment, which has only more recently, in the last few years, gotten back to about what it was in the early 70s. Well, the first year I was here, I spent a great deal of effort and time in trying to get the health sciences center organized. Mm-hmm. had an initial conference, which I got the right people, Lester Evans, and from the Macy Foundation and the
Commonwealth.
What?
Lester Evans was with the Commonwealth.
Oh, the Commonwealth, yes, Commonwealth. And the Ebert from Harvard and so on, to come in and give us advice. And
was Pellegrino at that conference?
No.
I didn't think he was.
Mm-hmm. No. But we were raising the question of the search, what kind of a person, and what sort of philosophy. And it was at that time that someone mentioned that Pellegrino at the University of Kentucky looked like he might be the right person. And so I asked him to come up and visit with us. And we were very much attracted. He's certainly a magnetic kind of person. And pretty soon he was on board. Also, there was a question of picking an architect. And here I'm somewhat to blame, because when visiting Chicago, I'd been quite impressed by the attractive appearance of the Marina Towers, two big apartment towers in downtown in the Loop area of Chicago.
Circular?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I said, well, we might think about asking the architect of the Marina Towers, Goldberg, I think his name was, to submit some designs. And sure enough, he became the architect for the Health Sciences Center.
Did you have
I'm not sure whether it turned out for the best.
Yeah. Did it have anything to do with George Dudley in that case?
George Dudley?
No. He was one of the three first trustees of the construction fund.
Mm.
What was
the... Of course, we didn't actually pick the architect. We sent up a recommendation, but evidently it clicked somewhere. I also, visiting out in Los Angeles that first year, I asked George Beadle if he knew of anyone in the health sciences who was particularly interested in the development of genetics, human genetics, in its relation to medicine, because I could foresee already in 1965 that this was going to be the big thing coming along in the future. And he said, well, there's a man at the City of Hope Hospital who's been taking some, participating in seminars with us. And we all think he's got a lot on the ball, very able, capable person. I said, all right, give me his name. I'll get in touch with him. It's Al Clemson. So pretty soon I had Ed Pellegrino and Al Knutson on board. Unfortunately, although they're each very good men in their own right, they didn't hit it off too well together. Personally, yes. But Pellegrino is a very dominating kind of person. Al Knutson, rather than force his opinion, would pull back and put himself in the background too much. And so I think he never achieved as much here as I had hoped he might. And certainly he did not, in those early days, as I wanted to see it, Health Sciences Center developing with, from the very beginning, a strong emphasis on medical genetics. And instead it turned out to be very conventionally organized as far as medicine is concerned. Only now they're beginning to realize that they've got to get some medical geneticists on board. And but Otherwise, the idea that Pellegrino had of, I think it was his idea, that the health sciences should not be just a medical school, but should include a school of dentistry, a school of allied health professions, a school of nursing, and so on. Basic health sciences is a separate thing from the medical school. That worked out pretty well.
What has happened to allied health sciences? I think there are only five now, five of the
couple. Well, MacTernan is still here, at least he was last year.
Well, isn't he social work? Isn't he the head of...
No, he was allied health professions. Yes, there was a school of social welfare also. I never knew quite what it amounted to.
I see.
He was the allied health professions.
I see.
And,
or maybe they dropped that.
You see, we worked out a very nice program in the 70s for the training of genetic counselors in the School of Allied Health Professions. And he thought that it would come under the rubric that he'd already cleared with Albany and with the head of the Health Sciences Center. It was Howard Oakes by that time. And so he didn't go through the routine of getting formal permission for the program at the beginning. And after we had a first year class well launched and doing splendid work, he was slapped down for having initiated an unauthorized degree program. No, there was to be no more degree programs because there was a freeze on expansion, budgetary freeze.
Now this was MacTernan?
Yeah, that's MacTernan, I see. So, it was just too bad. Now, one of the things that created, well, then I spent a good deal of time that first year, let's go back to that, on the Marine Sciences Center, looking for a person to head up that program. We eventually got Donald Squires to come from Smithsonian.
Yeah.
And we worked hard to, we had a big opportunity to develop a tropical station on the north shore of Jamaica. But, and we got Tom Garrow, who'd been in Australia working on the barrier reef, to come and head that laboratory. And then that all fouled up because you couldn't run it without a boat. And the whole program had to be run in cooperation with the University of Jamaica, which would supply local facilities and so on. But we need the boat. And it turned out there was just no way you could get the authorities in Albany to agree to the purchase of a boat that would be working in Jamaica. Mm-hmm. And also that
vision was fairly parochial.
It was about that time that I coined that phrase, which the kind of wry humor that I'm not usually very good at, but dealing with the Albanians. We became a very real chore, an obstacle in many development, many of these programs. I think the whole State University of New York system is badly conceived. There are just too many campuses at too many different levels for one board of trustees and one central administration to operate. And in trying to develop an adequate budget for all of these, dividing up the kitty, it usually comes out that they're not very generous helpings for anybody, particularly after Nelson Rockefeller retired and was succeeded by other governors.
Kerry and Cuomo.
Kerry and Cuomo. I thought Cuomo talks one way and acts the other, you know. He's not really very helpful to higher education. He just hasn't put the enthusiasm and the money into it that it requires.
Has he gone through it himself?
I don't know. You see, I had some experience with the California system where they really have three separate systems. The community colleges are not in with the others. They have their own board of trustees and their own separate budget. And then there are the four-year colleges. Now it's the some of them have acquired graduate programs, but most of them are essentially at an undergraduate level. And then there's the University of California, which has its limited number of campuses, and they each can go to the have their own trustees, and they can go their own way to the legislature and the governor. And I think, as we have it in New York, the central administration of the state university just doesn't even know what's going on. They don't know what's going on at Stony Brook. They don't know what the needs are here.
They don't even come
once
out.
A year, they call the administrators from the local campus up for a hearing. And you go up with time with hopes and arguments, and get your face crushed in. And it wasn't too bad when I was academic vice president, although I soon learned the facts of life. But since then, it's been bitter. Because there really has been a financial squeeze. And I don't think they've ever had anyone in the central administration who is really willing to say, to make the decision that we don't just share everything out in dribbles so everybody will have a little, but we're going to build one real center of excellence. So the result is that there is no center of excellence, I think.
Well, you've got an upstate, downstate division, which it has been
that true. Yeah. In addition to the Marine Sciences Center and the Health Sciences Center here, I have CED as a topic, the chairmanship problems, the composition of the AVB office, appointment and tenure problems. We discussed some of those, not all of them, and relations with Toll, Ross, Gelber, Weisinger, Pellegrino, and Irvine. Maybe it'll take another session. I find my voice is about to get hoarse.
All right, well, we're getting to the end of the second side, side B of this tape one. What, you want to quit? And
let me just, if we've got a little more space there, I can finish up with something quickly.
All right.
I mentioned Charlie Hoffman in the AVP office.
Right.
I had two other persons who were assistants to the vice president who were very helpful and able. Oakes Ames, marvelous guy, and Merton Reitler.
Mm-hmm.
Merton I saved. He was going to be denied tenure in political science. And Martin Travis, who is a good friend as well as chairman of the department, a good friend of Merton's, came to me and said, he's a good man, but and he's a pretty good teacher, but he's not going to do any research, and the department's unwilling to recommend him for tenure. What can we do with him? And I said, I do need another assistant, and if you think he's capable of good personnel relations, I'll take him into my office. And I saved him that way.
Good.
For the university. I think he's worked out very well. Better than most of the faculty members who've gone into administration. I took on Vera Farris to be a kind of watchdog over the Black Studies program.
After she left the health science?
No, she was never in health science. She was an instructor in biology.
Oh?
And a splendid teacher. Everyone thought she was one of the finest teachers on campus.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't really want to take her out of teaching, but I thought she ought to find out what administration was like. And she worked there for a year, but then she went back to teaching. She said, it's not for me. I can't get along with the head of the Black Studies program.
Mm-hmm.
And
who appointed that person?
I don't remember. Now, that's a question, you see.
Mm-hmm.
I never had any control over the Black Studies program or some of these other sort of non-departmental things.
Johnny did it?
Yes. Either Johnny or Alec Pond, or maybe it was the dean for and eventually vice president for liberal arts.
And Sidney Gelber?
Sidney Gelber, somebody. I don't remember just what year that was, actually. During my time as AVP, and we won't go beyond that, I got along very well with Toll, but I did find that toward the end of my experience that there were some things he'd held out on me. I mean, information that I should have had,
yes,
he didn't convey to me. And it made my task very difficult. Stan Ross, we got along very well, very pleasantly, but I describe him as a person who played his cards very close to his chest.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to run the College of Arts and Sciences, and he did run it. And he didn't care too much about telling me about what was going on. Gelber, I got along with very, very well. We were close friends, and I admire and feel great affection for him. Weisinger was a difficult person. He was difficult as chairman of English, but he was far more difficult as dean of graduate studies.
Who appointed him? How did he get that position?
Well, I think this was Johnny and Alec. John, it was a surprise to me when John came in one day and said, well, next year we're going to have an executive vice president as well as the academic vice president. And I think that Alec Pond chairman of physics would be very good in that position. I could think of a dozen reasons why I didn't think so, but it didn't seem very politic to say it because he was had already made up his mind. The administration was too heavily overburdened with scientists. Mm-hmm. And one thing I'd talked to Johnny about a number of times was that I had to constantly lean over backwards to give my faculty the assurance that I'm not just a scientist, that I'm working in behalf of the humanities and the social studies, as well as the sciences and engineering. And that's why I heartily approved the choice of Stan Ross as dean of the College of Arts and Sciences in Gilbert. By that time it became...
I appointed Stan as dean.
What?
I appointed Stan as dean.
Yes.
See, I joined the campus as the acting head and dean of arts and sciences, both.
Mm-hmm.
And I soon found out
you couldn't
couldn't do both.
And you appointed Stan, and he stayed on in that position.
Yeah.
And when he left, then...
When did he leave?
I guess it was after about 68. And Johnny and I discussed the possibilities, and we picked Sid Gelber.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was great, because Gelber represents philosophy, and he represents music, and helps to balance. And I approved of the choice of Weisinger, too, because there again, it was humanities coming in. But my trouble with Weisinger is that he would never report to anything to me. He wanted to run the graduate school as his little thief.
Yeah.
And at the end of my term, I tried to spend a good part of my last year writing up my 6 years of experience as academic vice president.
Good. Go ahead.
And I wanted each of the deans to
do the same
and transmit it to me so I could work it into the full report. And he would never do a thing. He hadn't done it previously, and he didn't do it that year either. He never reported anything to me about the activities of his graduate school.
Well,
is there a little more?
Yes, so we bet.
The thing that irked me most in the final year was that I discovered that before I got my total budget for the academic part of the university, a huge sum had been taken out without my knowledge and assigned to the computing center to support it. And this is something that Alec Pond, who was not only executive vice president, but he ran that office of budget preparation, you see, and was the principal spokesman when the team went up to Albany to ask for funds. He'd worked this out, and I don't know whether Johnny agreed to this or not, but it was something like $600,000 a year out of the academic budget. It was just assigned arbitrarily to the computing center. Now, I wasn't even told. I didn't know it had gone there. I suppose that what I was given was the original allocation appropriation for the academic budget, but it wasn't. Now, I fully agree that the departments ought to be putting money into the support of the computing center. I would have been the first one to insist on this. I just didn't like it being done under...
Behind your back.
Underhand.
Yes. Right.
And Pellegrino was, he just ran things himself. He didn't want to report either. He not only wouldn't report to me, because I was just a vice president, as he was, but he wouldn't report to Johnny. Irvine was a model dean. I had never any problems with Tom Irvine.
Yeah.
problems with chairmanship, so that the most difficult administrative problems I had, I think, were easing out chairmen who felt they had a vested interest in a department they had virtually established, and when their faculties became restive or rebelled, wanted a new chairman, they didn't want to step down.
Obsolescence in the administration.
But I must say, I think I worked that out very satisfactorily in every case, so that every one of those ousted chairmen remained a good personal friend of mine.
Well, that takes a lot of doing, but it's a good test. Well, I think we're about at the end here.